Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Tomorrow is not only Thanksgiving, it's the first day of Hanukkah. In other words, it's Thanksgivica, a made-up word for this unusual collision of holidays. I even read about menorki, that's a menorah in the shape of a turkey. We have two Philadelphia chefs who'll be joining us in just a few minutes, but first, a short history of Hanukkah in America, which happens to be the name of Diane Ashton's new book. She's a professor of religion studies at Rowan University in New Jersey and joins us by telephone in this hour of Radio Times. And Diane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here, Marty.
So how unusual is it that Thanksgiving and Hanukkah, the first day of Hanukkah, share the same day?
It's exceedingly unusual. The last time was in 1888.
And I heard the next time will be 70,000 years from now. Is that correct?
Not quite. The next time will be in 2070. And after that, 2165. But you can see it's very, very rare.
What do you think of this word Thanksgivica and menorki? Do you like those?
I think it's advertising.
And is that a good thing?
It's what it is. This is America. Commerce and holidays are big business.
Interesting to read in your book about how Hanukkah has, I guess, evolved in this country, and it seems like it goes back to the 19th century, to Reform rabbis in Cincinnati. What was their thinking?
It's fascinating. These two rabbis both had national Jewish newspapers so they could publicize their new invention. And what they came up with was a Hanukkah festival for children in the synagogue. This is a novel celebration, but they wanted a way for Jewish children to have a connection to the synagogue. And so they created this Hanukkah festival. But the Hanukkah ritual itself is a very quick thing. You just light a candle, or however many for that day, and say a brief blessing, and it's done in 5 minutes. So they had to elaborate and make this into a big celebration, something that the children would look forward to. And so they turned to the women of their congregation, the religious school teachers and the mothers, who built all kinds of activities that children would like, anything from plays depicting the story of Little Red Riding Hood to drill teams where there were activities where children danced. So a wide variety of activities, but they were all focused on creating a Hanukkah festival for kids.
Were these rabbis, and perhaps even the women that worked with them, were they concerned that the Jewish children would start celebrating Christmas instead of Hanukkah?
I think their concern for this event particularly was really they want to create a sense of love for the synagogue in Jewish children. I don't think they were so concerned about Christmas with this event. But what they did for Hanukkah was that they began to urge parents to buy their children presents for Hanukkah. And that was definitely to help Jewish children feel that they had a holiday that they could enjoy and not envy their Christian playmates all their Christmas presents.
And, of course, it helped the retailers as well.
Yes.
How come Hanukkah has several different spellings?
Hanukkah is a Hebrew word, and it's always spelled the same way in Hebrew, chet, nun, kaf, hey. But the problem is that a chet has no comparable sound in English. And so people come up with all kinds of spellings depending on how they themselves pronounce Hanukkah. And if they use the chet sound all the time, they often will write a ch at the beginning of Hanukkah. But, of course, in English, that sounds like chair.
Yes.
So you don't end up with the sound of a chet. And so other people will just use an H. At least that's a throaty, breathy, throaty sound. And that Hanukkah, H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H, has been the way the New York Times has spelled it since 1889.
And is Hanukkah celebrated differently, let's say, in Israel? Are we talking about really a very Americanized version of Hanukkah?
In Israel, it's certainly celebrated, but it is nowhere near the commercial event that it is in the United States. People will light their menorahs, and the food that they eat in Israel is a jelly donut called a sufganiyot. And so all the bakeries have lots and lots of jelly donuts for Hanukkah. But it's not a big commercial event. Gift giving is not a big part of it.
It's interesting that the first day of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving are on the same day this year, because I wonder if there are some parallels between these two holidays having to do with perhaps gratitude or even religious freedom.
You're absolutely right. I found a newspaper from 1888, a Jewish newspaper, that really encouraged their readers to enthusiastically enjoy both Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, because Hanukkah is an occasion when we give thanks to God. Hmm. So we have two holidays that are basically about the same thing, thanking God.
And my understanding also is that Hanukkah often or always or generally centers around this idea of oil, the miracle of oil. What is the story there for the non-Jewish listeners in the audience?
Great story. So Hanukkah commemorates the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem. And the rabbis told a story that during that rededication, when the oil lamps were about to be lighted, and these oil lamps always remained lighted because they symbolized the presence of God. And so to rededicate the temple, you had to have these oil lamps. But the problem was that there was almost no oil left to do that with. The Maccabees found only a small vial of oil, and yet, miraculously, it lasted for 8 days until more could be made. And that's the story of why we celebrate Hanukkah for 8 days and light candles each night.
And what's the story of latkes?
Most Jews in the U.S. trace their heritage to people who came here from Eastern Europe. And in Eastern Europe, they eat a lot of potatoes.
Right.
So potato latkes were a very common food, and they're fried in oil. And so that became a standard meal to eat at Hanukkah.
And dreidels?
Dreidels. Dreidels became popular since the 1500s. In the Middle Ages, people began to use toys, and by the 1500s, in Germany, there were these tops that were used to play games with. And a dreidel is a small top with the letters for Nes Gadol Hayasham, a great miracle happened there, printed on their side, on each of the four sides of the dreidel. And you play this dreidel, and you spin it, and depending on where it lands, you either win or lose or put in or take out. It's a very simple game that kids can play. But the point is that Hanukkah is a time that people are supposed to be happy and celebrate and have fun. And so having fun with games at home became a standard part of the celebration.
I know Jewish families that have had Christmas trees in their house along with their Hanukkah celebration. Does that seem odd or unusual, Diane?
It's certainly unusual, but something that goes on in people's homes is really up to whatever they want to do with it. You know, families are really in charge of their celebration in their homes, and so they can tailor Hanukkah to their own tastes, their own finances, and their own commitments.
And what's on your menu for tomorrow, which is, of course, Thanksgiving?
Oh, turkey, a lot of vegetables. A friend of mine is bringing a pumpkin pie, and someone else is bringing a pecan pie. And so we're having a real Thanksgiving dinner. But we're also having a Hanukkah party on Saturday, and then we'll eat our latkes.
I wonder, too, whether interfaith marriages, and there are a lot of interfaith marriages in this country between Jews and other people of other religions or non-religions, do you think that has influenced the evolution of Hanukkah?
I think so. I think that because it's something that the families can really tailor to their own perspectives, I think it does become a holiday that's very flexible and that begins to really take on a different shape in each household.
And I wonder about even regional traditions, whether you find Hanukkah might be celebrated differently here in the Philadelphia area versus New York or New Orleans or Los Angeles.
That was one of the more interesting things I found in doing the research for this book, is that I found each locale tailoring this celebration to their own tastes. So, for example, the men's club of a synagogue in Fort Worth, Texas, sells latkes, And you can get those latkes either with a traditional Eastern European recipe, which is basically just potatoes and onions, or you can get it with a Mexican flavor. And they're probably the only place in the country where you can get Mexican-flavored latkes. Mm-hmm.
And is there something about the Philadelphia region that, I mean, the kind of traditions, either food traditions or celebratory traditions having to do with Hanukkah that seem uniquely the tri-state or Philadelphia region?
I think what's distinctive to this tri-state area, and that's, you know, the area, we have a lot of Jews here. And
we
so,
do.
So Hanukkah is a very familiar event to most of the people in this area because most people know some Jews, and so they hear about it, or they see Hanukkah items for sale in grocery stores. They'll see Hanukkah greeting cards and wrapping paper and paper plates for Hanukkah parties, and so it's a familiar thing.
I also notice, and this is not just true here in the Philadelphia area, but in town squares now, you'll see a creche, you'll see, you know, the three wise men, and you'll also see a menorah.
Right. And this is something that's happened for the last, I think, 30 years, going back into the 70s. Maybe it's more than 30 years. But these very large Hanukkah menorahs are erected by the Chabad Lubavitch, who are a group who are really trying to promote Jewish activities, Jewish life, Jewish allegiance to Jews everywhere. And they are bringing the Hanukkah celebration into a much more public awareness than previously.
And we're almost out of time here, but the takeaway I get from your book is that Hanukkah in America is a tradition that has evolved over the years and probably will continue to evolve. Is that sort of the thesis of your book?
Absolutely. I think it's something that Jews in America have always tailored to their own interests and creativity and their own needs, and I think they'll continue to do that.
And when you were a little girl, what's a Hanukkah memory for you?
Oh, I think a Hanukkah memory for me was always opening that gift box, and there was always something warm to wear. It was a sweater, it was a jacket, it was warm socks or pajamas, but in Buffalo, it was always something warm.
And Buffalo, we know there's winter about 6 months out of the year.
At least.
At least. Well, Diane Eshton, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, and happy Thanksgivica to you.
And to you, Marty.
Thanks so much. And that's Diane Eshton, and she's a professor of religion studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, and she has a book called Hanukkah in America. It's a look at how Hanukkah has evolved in this country. Well, as I said, we have two chefs waiting in the wings. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to start our conversation with them. We'll be talking about how to prepare that holiday meal. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
AT12 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. From the creative team that brought you This Is the Week That Is and our show of shows, 1812 Productions celebrates the holidays with its newest original production, The Big Time, New Vaudeville for the Holidays, featuring Jennifer Childs, Scott Greer, and Dave Jadico. The Big Time reunites Philadelphia's comedy dream team and brings the steamer trunk circuit into the 21st century. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the holiday film fair that will cap off a good year at the movies.
I think we're going to end up looking at what we've seen this year and be quite amazed at the depth and power and creativity of some of the films that have come out.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. For years now, we have hosted essentially the same show on the day before Thanksgiving, how to prepare that holiday meal. What has made it new and fun and different are the variety of guests that we have booked. Today, something from this smoky southern barbecue tradition and all the things you can do with vegetables. And let me introduce our two guests who join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Aaron O'Shea is executive chef and partner of Percy Street Barbecue at 9th and South Streets here in Philadelphia. Aaron O'Shea, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're happy to have you here as well. And also with us is Rich Landau. He's chef and co-owner of the restaurant Veg with his wife, Kate Jacoby. They've written a cookbook together. It's called Veg, 100 Plates, Large and Small, that Redefine Vegetable Cooking. And Rich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And happy Thanksgiving to all of you and to our listeners as well. That line is open at 1-888-477-9499. I suggest you call early. We generally get inundated with phone calls with questions about how to cook that Thanksgiving meal. 1-888-477-WHYY. And you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Rich, I'm curious about, because I do think Thanksgiving is such a family-oriented meal. I think we all have memories from our childhood of certain things that our grandmother cooked or our mother or father cooked. Are there certain Thanksgiving memories from you, from your childhood?
Well, a lot of it was about just the food in general and the family gathering. You know, I used to look forward to just seeing my family on Thanksgiving. And the food, you know, it was there, but it wasn't what it was all about. You know, and the food was delicious. And, you know, I gave up meat for ethical reasons.
You were a little kid, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was a little kid. And I gave it up for ethical reasons, not because I missed the taste. So I still cook like a meat lover, you know. I like those deep, smoky, roasted flavors of food. And that's how we cook at the restaurant. So I'm always trying to emulate those, you know, flavors and, you know, memories when I'm cooking any meal, let alone Thanksgiving.
How about for you, Aaron? You grew up in the Eastern Shore area. What is a Thanksgiving memory for you?
Let's see. My grandmother's mashed potatoes are probably the star of the show. And it was really maybe the first thing that I ever made.
Tackled.
Yeah. And actually, she did all the work, but she let me help her. And I just remember that was such an honor because nobody touched the mashed potatoes except Grandma.
So. Well, can you share her recipe on the air with us?
Oh, you know, it's just
the basics.
It's don't hold back on the butter or the cream. you know, plenty of salt and pepper. And it was just going through the motions with her and her allowing me to do that and holding the mixer in the pot.
On the stove.
Right, on the stove. And I remember that was just such an honor.
So. Let me talk turkey with you, and you can chime in, Rich, and we'll talk vegetables with you as well. But Aaron, I know you were cooking a lot of turkeys yesterday. I don't know. First of all, how many did you cook yesterday?
We did 100 turkeys.
You go.
Yes. So that was... I'm glad that they're done. They're getting picked up today, so we're sending our birds off.
What are some basics just for, are you a brining person? Are you a no brining person? Let's do some basic stuff with cooking a turkey.
I do brine because we're not breaking the turkey down and cooking it in separate parts, so I think it really helps that breast meat. We brine our turkey for 24 hours, which gives it... The whole brining process, your salt's going to come in. We'll keep it really simple, but the salt comes in and kind of breaks down the cell walls and then allows more water to come in. And so when you're cooking your turkey, you lose a lot of moisture.
Right.
But because you've kind of added it, it will hold more moisture in the end.
And how about the opening and shutting of the oven? I mean, once the turkey's in the oven, leave it alone, let it do its thing?
Yes, 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 yes. We have our instructions that we give with our turkey packages, and that's the last sentence. It's, please don't open your oven too much. Because the more you do that, the longer it's going to take.
And so the idea of taking all those juices and pouring it on top, just let it do its thing?
Right, right. You just want to do it, you know, a few times, baste, right. Close it up. And you're good to go.
And leave it alone.
Yeah.
How about for you, Rich? In terms of I guess, good sides. And I'm thinking about all the wonderful grains that we have now, and I'm assuming that's another way of thinking about how to add to that Thanksgiving feast.
Yeah, well, you know, for us, we try to avoid the whole, you know, make a vegetarian meal out of sides only, because there's so you can do a centerpiece. And now, you know, most of us grew up with the turkey as the center of the table. You had this giant centerpiece, and all the other dishes literally were on the side.
Yes.
And as a vegetarian, that's what we ate. And, you know, first of all, rule number one, chicken stock is not vegetarian. So grandmothers out there, if you're trying to please the vegan, you know, that your kid brought home from college.
You can't sneak in the chicken stock.
Chicken stock is not vegetarian. So rule number one.
Okay,
but
fair enough.
But most of all, getting back to that point, I think it's important to have a centerpiece. Why not? Vegetables can be a centerpiece. How about like a whole butternut squash cut in half and roasted really slowly in the oven until it melts, you know, rubbed with spices and a little olive oil. Portobello mushrooms, I know they're a little 1992, but, you know, they're absolutely delicious if they're roasted right. Something you can cut with a knife and fork, not just spoon onto your side. So, you know, and our book touches on this, that we really want to move vegetables into the center of the plate again. And so why not have that centerpiece? Eggplant makes a, you know, whole roasted eggplants really slowly in the oven with all the spices you would use. You know, the Thanksgiving flavors are, you know, not relegated to just turkey. They're great on vegetables. So put a big centerpiece in the middle of the table, and then you can still have the sides, and then you have a vegetable-based Thanksgiving.
So the vegetables aren't the co-star of the meal, for instance. They're one of the stars.
Exactly. They're one of the stars, which in, historically, I mean, the very first Thanksgivings did not have any turkey. So talk about tradition.
Yeah, there
we're,
you
right,
go.
We're right back in there, right?
And why are portobello so 1992? I miss that.
Well, I kind of laugh at this stuff because, you know, they come into vogue, and then they become kind of cliche. You know, portobello mushrooms, the cliche vegetarian meat replacement. I love portobello mushrooms, and I love, you know, everything else that's come and gone, like sun-dried tomatoes and kiwis and all this stuff. So still food, right?
As it certainly is in my book. Erin, what are some sides or some vegetables that you like for Thanksgiving?
I love, excuse me, I love collard greens. We touched a little bit earlier. I love the mac and cheese.
Yeah, we were talking about mac and cheese a lot before we went on the air. Is there something special in your mac and cheese? Or does it, I mean, mac and cheese is sort of speaks for itself.
Yeah, our mac and cheese is very straightforward. But we use a nice quality cheese, and we don't hold back. I mean, I feel like on Thanksgiving night, like, just don't hold back. Right. Enjoy it. Have this crazy, delicious meal that's very rich, and you don't want to do that every day, but you could do it then.
Once a year.
Yeah.
And what about your collards? How do you like to prepare them?
We use smoked ham hocks and bacon as well. So we kind of go a little crazy on the pork and the collards. I actually don't like to cook my collards for too long. I don't like them to be mushy. I like there to be a little texture there.
So how long do you cook them?
Ours go for really about a half an hour.
Right. Are you a collard person?
I love collards. I love collards, and I agree with Erin that, you know, it's a crime to overcook vegetables like that. It's a crime to overcook any vegetable. And, again, not to shamelessly plug our book here, but we touch on that in the sense that vegetables have a very, very small window of doneness. And I always thought it was ironic that people get very, very concerned and obsessed with how, you know, delicately you have to cook your fish and your meat, you know, to this perfect doneness. You know, the whole touching of your face,
right,
which I never understood. It's just kind of weird. But, you know, the vegetables have a very small window of doneness. Who wants mushy vegetables? You know, we cook whole carrots, jumbo whole carrots, very slowly at the restaurant. And I tell, you know, the cooks, you know, don't cook them until they're mushy. If they're mushy, nobody wants mushy vegetables. That's baby food. And yet at the same time, nobody wants a crunchy carrot that looks like it's cooked. You have to, when you eat it, the knife has to just glide through it with just the right amount of resistance. So there's a very small window of doneness with all vegetables, and collards the same. They can become mushy very fast, and yet if you undercook collards, you've got a fibrous, chewy mess in your mouth, too. You've got to be very careful with this stuff.
You've used the word slow cook for a while. Is that your approach to cooking vegetables?
For some and for others, we do a very quick cook. We do a lot of flash grilling, a lot of really intense high heat searing where you kind of get a browning on the outside of the vegetables, and then they'll do different stages of cooking elsewhere in the kitchen, like on the grill, in the oven. But, you know, we use as many different methods as there are vegetables for cooking.
Let me reintroduce the two of you, and then I do want to get some callers in the conversation. This is our annual show, the day before Thanksgiving. We talk about how to prepare that holiday meal. And our guests are Rich Landau. He's the chef and co-owner of a restaurant here in Philadelphia called Veg. It's at 12th and Locust Street. And as he mentioned, they do have he and his wife have a new cookbook, and it's called Veg, 100 Plates Large and Small that Redefine Vegetable Cooking. And Aaron O'Shea is the executive chef and partner of Percy Street Barbecue at 9th and South Street. So we are covering the meat and the vegetables here on Radio Times. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Katie from Havertown joining us on Radio Times. Katie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. I was listening to Fresh Air yesterday with the chefs from America's Test Kitchen.
Yes.
And they were talking about whether or not to stuff your turkey with the stuffing. And so I wanted to get input on that, what they, the guests think is the right way to do it or the best way to do it. And the other question I have is for some tips on grilling the turkey outside on the grill. And I know the brining is one suggestion. Right. But if they have any other suggestions on time and the right way to cook it on the grill.
Fair enough. That's in your court.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Katie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Katie, the first part, Aaron, was about to stuff or not to stuff. And
right.
I mean, is there a controversy here?
Well, I mean, I think it has a lot to do with how you're going to cook your turkey. You know, at the restaurant, we smoke our turkeys, so I do not stuff because I don't want the whole meal to be smoky.
Right.
You want it to be a part of the meal and an accent to the meal. But my mother always stuffed when she was roasting.
Mine as well.
I think the important thing is that you have to remember to get that stuffing out of the bird, so that the bird can cool down properly as well as the stuffing. And just want to make sure that when you're reheating that, you do reheat it thoroughly.
Right. And how about grilling turkeys on the grill?
Grilling turkeys on the grill.
I've never had the nerve to do this, especially on Thanksgiving itself. But.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the smoking and the grilling are very different things. So I was thinking about this morning, and I would actually be very nervous to grill a turkey only because I don't work with grills to that extent. You have to be able to control your temperature.
Right.
And when you're working with a natural heat source, you have different environments. You know, it's different from the smoker. 325 is a good temperature to go with on your grill. You want to maintain that. A 15-pound bird, you're going to look at 3 to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. But just really constantly watching that grill. And if you go over, you know, you want to be careful to back off, maybe take some coals away. So that's the only thing. It's not something that everyone does every day. So you really want to keep an eye on your temperature.
Thanks for the call, Katie, to Radio Times. And Rich, let me go to you because it seems to me one can have stuffing without the bird.
Oh, absolutely. It's usually vegetarian if you follow the no chicken stock rule. Yeah, it's great, you know. And the you know, if you want to talk about whether or not you're going to stuff your portobello mushrooms, that's not really an issue because it's going to cook pretty fast.
Right.
So yeah, that's one of my favorite things at Thanksgiving, actually.
Is stuffed portobellos?
Oh, just stuffing.
Just
in general.
Plain old stuff. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you can have so much fun with it.
We have an email from Anne from Devon. Any special tips for cooking a chocolate heritage turkey? They're 50% white, 50% dark meat. Do you know, Aaron, anything? I don't know about a chocolate heritage turkey. And does it matter if it's 50-50?
Well, that generally means that you're going to have more dark meat than you normally would.
Right.
You want to get to your legs to 165. So I would just keep an eye on the temperature. Maybe cover those breasts after a little bit because those legs are going to take longer to cook. And then, you know, the consequence to that is possibly drying out the breast meat.
Tricky stuff. I always wonder, Rich, about just planning the day. And I think when people, let's say you have a dozen or maybe even 20 people coming over, that doesn't happen every Saturday night. And just being prepared and timing things on right and not feeling completely harried during Thanksgiving Day. Do you have suggestions for the cookers in our audience?
It's all about planning, too. You know, you have to pre-cook a lot of the stuff. You cannot cook everything to order. First of all, restaurants don't do that. As much as you see on TV all these chefs doing this a la minute stuff, that really doesn't exist that much anymore. A lot of things are really pre-prepared and then finished at a restaurant, and you should follow the same rules at home.
Finished in a microwave or in an oven?
No, on the stovetop. I mean, okay. Let's take, for example, greens. Blanch off all your greens. If you want to use spinach or kale or what have you, blanch them off, boiling salted water, shock them in ice water, squeeze out the liquid, and then you can just finish them on the stovetop real quick in a quick 5-minute saute. Your squashes, your potatoes, all your roots, pre-roast them until they're almost done, just a little crunchy, and then you finish them last minute. This has absolutely no outcome on the final product whatsoever. If you did them all the way through versus, you know, half cooking them, you won't notice any difference. And you have to make your life easy that day. It's a really big day, and not just the food, but you have all these people in your house. They need drinks. They need appetizers. Where do you put your coats? Make your life easy. Uh-huh. Enjoy the day. And think of a really good variety of food that's not going to be very labor-intensive. I find the most colorful, beautiful foods are the easiest to prepare. And I've, you know, we wrote in our first cookbook a story about ugly food, that, you know, the classic Thanksgiving table is all brown and gray and bubbling cauldrons of brown stuff. It's ugly food. Let's get some greens and yellows and reds in there, and they're very easy to prepare.
And clean as you go, Aaron, and then we'll get back to our callers. I've never quite mastered that myself.
Absolutely.
But halfway through, it's just a big mess.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's funny, Rich, you're talking about planning ahead and just the logistics of everything. We did 100 turkeys this year at Percy Street and, you know, I think 35 full dinners and, you know, the planning that goes into that, your oven space, your stove space, and everything that you need to do, keeping yourself clean, doing everything that you can ahead of time. Think about, you know, what you can do to, you know, you could make your stuffing or your dressing ahead of time and reheat it that day. It's going to be fine. All of those things, yes.
Well, you know what? We have about a minute before our break here, and then I do want to get back to our callers. Let me just ask you about cranberry sauce. Is that something you do, Rich?
Yeah, I've never been a huge fan of cranberry sauce. I don't love sweet with my savory food, but we do cook it. You know, it's funny, on that episode of Chopped, we were on the guy, my competitor.
Chopped. You won Chopped.
He cooked cranberries with Merlot. I cooked mine with water, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's a great idea. So, you know, get some booze in that cranberry sauce. Thanksgiving, after all.
What do you think, Erin?
I love cranberries. I love the pop, you know, the fresh cranberries. I love the texture of them. They kind of pop in your mouth. And cranberries and orange are a beautiful combination. Getting some fresh orange zest in there is really nice. I love the sweet and the tart. So, yeah, I'm a big fan.
Okay, well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And our phones have exploded at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We're talking about how to prepare that Thanksgiving meal. And again, Erin O'Shea, executive chef and partner of Percy Street Barbecue at 9th and South Streets here in Philadelphia, is our guest, along with Rich Landau. He's the chef and co-owner of the restaurant Veg with his wife, Kate Jacoby. That's at 12th and Locust, and they have co-authored a new cookbook, and it is called Veg. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Get ready to feel the pulse, WHYY's newest program, bringing you stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. On the first show, December 6th, we'll navigate the murky waters of medical billing and meet the people who are trying to make things less maddening for all of us. Also, a doctor shares her story about what it feels like to make a mistake. The Pulse, Friday morning, December 6th at 9 on WHYY.
Made possible by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
One, two, three, four! Volume 2 of The Beatles On Air Live at the BBC has just been released. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the album's executive producer, Kevin Howlett, who also wrote the new book, The Beatles, The BBC Archives. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Imagine world peace. Okay, imagine Hanukkah and Thanksgiving getting together. Yummy.
You are going to see a lot of sweet potato latkes this year. Brussels sprout latkes.
Won't happen again for 70,000 years. One turkey, 8 days, and a dreidel or two. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Rich Landau and Erin O'Shea, and talking to callers as well. Looks like we have Molly from Princeton, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. And Molly, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Hi. You already alluded to some answers to my questions. I'm cooking a pretty traditional dinner, and I'm wondering how I keep things warm that I have pre-prepared, or how do I reheat them, and what are the things I really shouldn't do that to? What are the things that I should wait till the last minute to have ready to go?
Fair enough. Erin, can I toss that first to you about, I guess, how do you keep things warm, assuming that people have, you know, one oven and maybe a, you know, radiator somewhere, I don't know.
Right. You may need to get creative. I think getting things close to ready is important. And then just really planning out the time that you have with your oven and your finishing time, and the time that everything takes to get to the table. Think about your stove, your stovetop. Water baths are nice for keeping things warm. Uh-huh. If you have a pot full of water and you can put your bowl on top, that's a nice gentle way to keep things warm. You're not going to cook it down too much. Maybe things like gravy.
Yeah. How about for you, Rich? And I guess she's also asking, you know, what things can I cook ahead on and what makes sense to cook at the last minute?
Well, gravy, Erin just said, that's a great thing to just cook on your stove and just leave it on the back of your stove. Room temperature is not a terrible thing to hold most of your vegetables and, you know, food products in, as long as it's under 2 hours. Mm-hmm. After 2 hours, that's when the bacteria starts to grow. That's when food starts to go bad. So if you give your food 2 hours at room temperature, that's fine. And then you can get it back in the oven. My ideal situation is all the roots and the squashes, have them ready to go in separate baking pans or sheet pans, throw them all in the oven last minute under tin foil, you know, so they steam themselves a little bit, and have it timed up where they can all go in at the same time and all come out. And then the things you actually want to cook last minute, and we just touched on this, were your greens, your green vegetables and your very delicate vegetables that you can just give a quick saute to. They go in the pan and then right onto the table.
Molly, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me see what Marla from Fitler Square has to say. Hi, Marla. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi, I've got three questions. One is, do you recommend a convection oven if you have it? Two, what about air drying in the refrigerator and for how long? And the third question is, if you're doing a kosher turkey, what do you put under the skin? Do you have to put less salt? Can you put thyme? Those are my questions.
Okay, Marla, let's start at the first one, the convection oven. Where do we stand on convection ovens?
Love them.
Yeah.
We love them?
Wonderful.
Yeah, okay,
all right.
I was just checking.
It's a challenge when you don't have one.
Yeah, I agree. They'll change your life and you can't go back.
I have to say, both of our guests are grinning from ear to ear with the word convection oven.
Yeah, that's going to speed things up and still treat things gently and keeps that air moving around. And so you've got less hot spots.
Yeah, it cooks them more consistently.
She also had a question about air drying.
Got me on that
I
one.
Don't, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure what she's talking about, but you're not going to do much drying in a refrigerator anyway. So if you really want to dry something out, you've got moisture in that refrigerator. So that's the only thing I can think of is that I wouldn't.
Yeah, and the kosher thing, you might want to just check the internet on that. I'm not sure if you know about that, Erin, or
not. I can't comment on the kosher.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe just Google it and see what you come up with. Marla, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We didn't get to the dessert yet, and I want to make sure that we do that. Is there a dessert that you, for you, Erin, just means Thanksgiving?
Pecan pie, for sure. That's my favorite of all time. And pumpkin. And pumpkin. Apple. And all of them.
Very traditional. And is there anything, any trick to the kind of pies that you make?
The crust. I think, you know, the magic is in the crust. Just don't overwork your crust. Right. It's a very short pastry. It doesn't want a lot of working, and that way you'll get something flaky and beautiful.
How about for you, Rich?
Oh, I've never been a huge fan of pumpkin pie, but for me, my wife, Kate, is the pastry chef at Veg, so anything she makes is, to me, just top-notch. Any dessert she makes is just genius. She likes to incorporate a lot of spices and herbs and unusual savory ingredients into her dessert. You know, like take, for instance, rosemary, sage, allspice. You know, these are the Thanksgiving flavors. You can put rosemary and sage into a bag of potato chips, and it's going to taste like Thanksgiving to you.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, if you take any kind of dessert and kind of get some of these Thanksgiving traditional flavors in there, you have this new way of thinking about dessert for those of us who don't like pumpkin pie.
Shame on you.
I know.
Let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Actually, Rich, we have an email from Sarah. She's a vegan going to a traditional dinner. Should she expect the host to coordinate vegan-friendly foods? And I'm sure you have wrestled with this.
Well, Sarah, you know, expect little and be grateful for a lot. You know, it's very tough. You know, I like to be a gracious host when people come over our house. I like to take all of their needs into consideration and put them up front. If we had someone who was gluten-free coming over our house for dinner, I would make an all gluten-free meal and enjoy it that night. If someone didn't drink, I would probably not have them over my house. But those kind of things. But, you know, so it depends on the relationship you have. But expect very little. Maybe eat a little bit first. Mm-hmm. And be very grateful. Be very respectful. It's like when you go to a restaurant. You never demand a vegan meal. You ask politely, can I please have a vegan meal? And be very grateful. You know, it's a tricky thing. It's delicate.
Yeah. I'd be curious about your thoughts about that, Aaron. Then we'll get back to our callers. I mean, it sounds like it's up to the host also to ask whoever's coming for dinner, are there certain foods you like or don't like?
Right, absolutely. You know, and I guess it depends on your relationship, but, you know, maybe make the phone call and talk about it ahead of time and say, I can show up with this. And
or bring something to the meal.
Right, right. But, yeah, I agree with Rich. You know, if you're going over someone's house, it's kind of their ball game, and hopefully they'll take your needs into consideration.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Rhett from Lewistown, Pennsylvania, joining us. And Rhett, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hi, and hello to your guests, and happy holidays to you all.
Thank you. Same to you.
I'm enjoying this, and it's priming me up for what's to come tomorrow. A question on Pie Plus. I usually get the task of making pies, and I don't do it often, so it's inconsistent. Can you suggest one of the choices of fat that is used, lard, butter? I don't like Crisco, but and I know that ice cold water is important, but it's just like I hit and miss with the pie crust. So what can you tell me about that? And one other question before I forget. I drive a big truck, and I'm often through Philadelphia. Is there possibilities to park at either near or at either of your restaurants? When
Oh, you're such a nice caller, Rhett. Thank you for calling into Radio Times. And we all can identify with your crust question. Aaron, can I toss that first to you since you said it's all about the crust?
Sure. I love to use lard in my crust. I usually break it down between butter and lard. I think the important thing is make sure that your fat is very, very cold. Again, you don't want to overwork it. That ice water is just helping you to maintain that cold temperature. You know, get yourself all ready with everything that you need. Cut your fat ahead of time into small pieces so that you don't have to work it so much in order to incorporate it into the flour. And chill it before you roll it. Chill it before you bake it. Cold is very important.
Cold is, yeah. You want to add to that, Rich? I know it's your wife that's the pastry person, but...
Well, you know, there's a lot of great vegan products, plant-based shortenings out there. Earth Balance makes one that's just phenomenal. I don't mean to step on Aaron's toes here, but to me, I want to also avoid that Thanksgiving hangover the next day. So, you know, every year we get older, I want to eat a little bit better on Thanksgiving so my Friday isn't quite as painful all after, right. You know. A plant-based shortening works just as well as regular traditional shortenings. And, you know, it's a great product to use. You know, they've come so far. You know, so
and keep it cold. But the cold thing is important.
The cold thing is definitely important when making a crust.
Red, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And all I can say is good luck parking in Philadelphia.
I know,
there
right?
is parking, but no guarantee, I
maybe
guess.
Maybe park the truck and take a cab.
Let's see what Tom from Glenside has to say. Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I have a question for Rich. Hi.
Hi there.
Question for Rich. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Tom.
Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, my question is for Rich. Rich, I love veg, and my wife got the veg cookbook, and she made two recipes out of it the other day, and they were fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
You guys do such a great job.
Thanks.
My question is, what suggestions would you have about vegan stuffing? How do you make that stuffing so that it's just really good, you know, keeping it vegan? And any tips you have on that would be appreciated.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, you know, the keto, moisture is the keto good. A good stuffing to me. You got to get a good vegetable stock, a really good rich vegetable stock. At the restaurant, we char vegetables up in a little thin layer of very, very hot neutral oil first, and so you build your stock with a lot of deep flavor. You've got to have a good stock. You know, if you want to go out and get a bouillon cube or a powder, that's fine. It doesn't make you a bad person. Make your life easy at home. Just make sure it's very rich and very flavorful. Also, you need some fat. Olive oil makes a great fat for stuffing. It's also healthy. It's good for you. You can use a neutral oil. You can use a vegan butter that's out there. But you've got to get that that stuffing wet. So fat and stock and a lot of flavor. I think that's really important. You know what I like to do is put some grains into my stuffing. I tried years ago. I put rice in my stuffing one year when I just needed more stuffing and I didn't have enough. It was just wonderful how that worked with the bread in there. Quinoa, farro, frika, isn't that
the new grains?
Yeah, they're
play with.
So great. You know, get them in your stuffing. Get that textural and flavor thing going on in there. But yeah, there's no escaping the stock and the fat in stuffing.
Tom, thanks for the call. Let's see what Jill from Harleysville has to say. Jill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wish everybody a happy holiday.
Same to you.
But my question concerns the heritage turkey. I got one this year, and I'm not sure. I'm very confused on whether I brine or don't brine. I've been Googling, and there was all different messages out there. What's that, your
yes.
opinion?
Well, Jill, let me see what Aaron has to say about that.
I do brine. I recommend brining myself. You know, your bird is made up mostly or of a large percentage of water, just like we are. And what happens when you're cooking that is it's going to lose a lot of that moisture. The brining process lets you add a little bit more moisture before you start roasting that bird or grilling or smoking. So the percentage that it loses, you're still left with more moisture, especially in that breast meat.
Right. So think brine.
I do, yeah.
Jill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Eileen from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Eileen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We are new to Center City and fortunately have access to a rooftop with a very large grill. So my assignment is to bring vegetables to the Thanksgiving Day dinner. So I've got asparagus and Brussels sprouts, fennel, three kinds of peppers, red, green, and yellow, and then eggplant. Do you have any tips on grilling? And given the weather, is it okay to grill today and bring them tomorrow?
Well, Eileen, let me see what Rich has to say. We're almost out of time, Rich, but go ahead.
Sure, real quickly. First of all, can I come over here Thanksgiving? That sounds awesome. Fresh vegetables like peppers, slice them up, grill them. Yes, absolutely do them the day before. They set beautifully in the fridge. The flavor develops. They'll be even better tomorrow. Some vegetables, your harder vegetables like your roots and your squashes, give them a roast in the oven first or even a blanch in salted water. And finish them on the grill. But all the vegetables you mentioned can go right on. Brussels sprouts I might give a 5-minute blanch for real quick, and then the last minute char on the grill.
Eileen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Rich Landau and Erin O'Shea, thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Thanks for joining us
today on Radio Times. And Rich Landau is chef and co-owner of the restaurant Veg, and he and his wife have co-authored a new book called Veg. And Erin O'Shea, executive chef and partner of Percy Street Barbecue. That's at 9th and South, and Veg is at 12th and Locust here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. We want to close things out with Cab Calloway. Everyone eats when they come to my house.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato, plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Davy, Tommy, Dora, Andre. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta fazula, Tulula. Oh, do have a bagel, bagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. There, you get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. 'Cause everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Don't make me coax you, moax you. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? You gotta eat if it chokes you. Oh, do have a knish, knishia. Ask him the latke, matke. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Buster, Cher, Chops, Fump. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
That is a great song. And again, that was Cab Calloway singing Everybody Eats When They Come to My House, a song written by Gene Burns.